Hi, everyone, and welcome to Palestine Exists, a space where we deep dive into all things Palestine, from history and politics to culture, resistance, and the stories that deserve to be told. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by the headlines, frustrated by misinformation, or just eager to learn more about Palestine beyond the mainstream narrative, this is the place for you. As always, hi, I'm Petra, and we have Habuba here. Hi, Habba.
Hi, Petura. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you? I miss you.
Good. I'm sorry. I was just watching this video. I'm sorry. Have you watched it? It's about a guy. I'm going to play it into the mic. Let me know if you can hear it, okay?
Okay, okay.
Okay.
I'm scared.
Here.
Can you spend this beautiful Palestinian woman a lot for ya? Can you spend her with a Palestinian woman? So much! Bro, do you know Rebecca got this place in 1948? Do you know that? I know that.
And like the entire time, this guy's like looking at the camera, like he's trying to. It's like that's how like freaking allies be like acting around us. And I'm sorry, it just made me giggle because he did the whole. Did you not know her family got displaced in 1948 during the Nakba? Like
the Nakba. I couldn't. Did you watch Tantura?
Have you watched Tantura? Excuse me, Dariyaseen.
Dariyaseen.
Oh my! I hate these batikha es. Let me stop. Anyways, sorry.
I haven't seen that video, Hiva. You should send it to me.
It sounds so very funny. It is. Okay, I'll put it and I'll probably post it on. I'll make Petra post it on our socials, so y'all can see it. But
Oh my goodness.
We are recording this episode, actually, on May 15th, 2025, and which marks officially 77 years. Since the Nakba or the ongoing Nakba. And we're trying not to be like Tantura or like watermelon batikha type, right?
Because everybody. 1948, on the evening of 1948,
right.
April 15th.
Yeah. It's just so ridiculous. I feel like it's so overdrawn. So we're trying, we've researched for days about this topic. And so yeah, this episode looks at what happens when a child loses more than their parents, when they lose basically the structure that should have protected them, named them, and claimed them. Palestinian orphanhood isn't just the result of war. It's part of the machinery of displacement, right? Mm-hmm. So we see that families aren't only killed, they're disassembled. And orphaning is used to interrupt continuity, or continuity, right? Mm-hmm. And it's done so purposely to destabilize identity, to make the next generation easier to manage or to move on or to forget. What did Golda Meir say? The old will forget and the young will. What did she say?
The old will die and the young will forget.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about children who are made rootless by design, not just without parents, but without papers, without land, without recourse. Children whose lives are shaped not only by loss, but by the systems that benefit from that loss. And it's not over. The Nakba wasn't a single event. Mm-hmm. It's a structure that keeps producing orphans. It keeps severing family ties. It keeps making Palestinian children into something the world can pity, but not really protect. This isn't going to be like, oh, be sad, whatever. It's not about sadness. It's about systems. Mm-hmm. And it's about how a settler project turns children into symbols and then abandons them. So let's start.
Very well said, Hiba. Yeah, I agree with you. I'm so tired of every May 15th hearing the Nakba started on Dariyaseen, blah, blah, blah. So we were like, what is a topic about the Nakba that people don't usually look into or don't often hear? And it was the orphans. You know, talking about it, it's going to be a hard episode. So just be warned, we are going to have testimonials from the Nakba days and currently. It was very, very hard researching this because there was a extreme challenge of accurate numbers of people being displaced, children, who was an actual orphan, what happened to mm-hmm. them, etc.
What it means to be an orphan as well.
Yeah, because in like Arab
I think we should, yeah, we'll define it now. I think it would be good, right?
Yeah, I feel like in Arab standard, you're an orphan if you lose one of your parents, right? So if you lose your mom, you're technically an orphan. If you lose your dad, you're technically an orphan. And if you lose both, you're a full orphan. So there's that. There's also a stigma within Arab cultures about orphans. And it's sad, but it's true. Usually they get pushed to a relative mm-hmm. if they're available, you know, and they live a crappy life with a relative. And if there's no one available,
like they're made to feel like leeches, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. And, you know, girls, girl orphans, if they are pushed to a family member, usually they're pulled out of school, get married, you know, whatever, and they don't even do their education. Boys, on the other hand, are pushed into work at a very, very young age, also pulled out of school. So it's just that trauma. And there's also orphanages within the Arab society are not the best. I hope everyone, when we say the Nakba, like I hope our listeners know what it means, but it's the Arabic definition or Arabic word for catastrophe. And mm-hmm. that it led to the displacement of over 750,000 Palestinians from within Palestine. Some were pushed into the West Bank, and then during 1967, they were pushed out to Jordan or Lebanon. Some were forcibly pushed out from all of Palestine to begin with. Yep.
And it didn't just happen in 1948. It started in 1947. I would argue it started
before then.
Yeah, before then as well. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, baby.
No. Go. I was saying, yeah.
And it was the destruction of over 534, am I right? 534 yeah. villages. When we mean destruction, it's not like, oh, they took a village, whatever, and then they named it like, what is it? Give me a name. Like, what is it? Hebron? And they
Hebron, named it instead of Khalil.
Yeah, instead of naming Hebron like Khalil, right? That, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about it's called, that's called Judaization. We're talking about like the actual destruction of villages, i.e. no records, no like survivors. If there are survivors, it exists as an oral tradition. And
hate honestly, to bring it up, but kind of like Santura.
Have you watched Santura?
But it is. Santura was fully erased. Everyone was wiped out, and then they built a village on top of that, and it's like no one talks about it.
Who was it that I was talking to that their village or their family home was now built into like a park or something?
Lena.
Was it Lena? Oh, Lena.
Yeah, Lena.
We miss you, Lena.
We miss come you, Lena.
You can come back, please.
Yeah, seriously. Come on now. It's so much fun when we had all three of us. My village was in Yaffa. It was one of the first villages that got wiped out. Right now, it's under Ben Gurion Airport. So yeah, fun. Even if we had the right of return, I can't even go back to my village because it was wiped out.
You know, our villages are so close. Give me a kiss right now.
Heba, we could have been besties in Palestine. We are raising besties. Our like cows and goats and picking our own.
Yeah, I thought you were about to say kids, bro. Get the.
No, I want animals, not kids. Animals are safer.
I'm not an animal person, but like I would have like watched you do it. Like it would have been cute.
I love cows. Cows are.
I'm
so
not
cute.
An animal person. You should know that about me. But I'll I'm a human that. Person. I love kids. I love babies. I love.
Khalas. I'll give you my babies and I'll take care of the animals. Trade.
Exactly. Okay. I have an animal or two you can take care of. Stop.
Oh okay. My god.
Stop. Okay, but sorry.
But
orphans. Orphans, Petra. We need to focus.
Sorry. But yeah, so just the chaotic, the chaoticness of it all, of the Nakba and violent nature of the events obviously made it very, very difficult to get precise casualty figures, including the numbers of the children who were orphaned. Record keeping didn't even start until later. Like we had no idea about the 750,000 until like years later, 2 to 3 years later.
That was because of the atlas. Let me go give you the website so you guys can buy it. It is from Palestine Land Society, so it's plands.org.
Mm-hmm.
And you can buy a PDF of it for, how much was it? Like $40. Oh. And yeah, and it talks about, there's 500 pages detailing towns, villages, landmarks, place names, and more. And 150 pages of analysis covering aspects of Palestinian history, geography, conflicts, etc. An atlas for people who don't know. It's just a book of maps or charts. So it's basically the most comprehensive thing that we have of Palestinian history. Obviously, there's more to be added, but this is the one that we have that's the most comprehensive. So yeah, the Atlas of Palestine. Go buy it, y'all. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead, Petura.
No, I love that. I didn't even know about that, but yeah.
I'll send it.
Please do. Yeah, but like record keeping was obviously not the first thing people thought of, right? After you were kicked out of your land, your family was killed, raped, murdered, everything you've known, everything is there. So yeah, the record keeping wasn't the best. What we do know from evidence is there were a significant number of orphans. Specifically, and again, I know this is very cliche with the villages I'm going to name, but this is the most known stuff we have. So massacres like Deir Yassin, there were eyewitness accounts and reports where over 100 people, including women and children, were killed. And they described this as a key event leading to Palestinian flight and displacement. Obviously, with the displacement, it caused family separation. So there was widespread displacement, destruction of Palestinian communities, which obviously led to a significant amount of children being separated from families and orphaned. And we do know this for a fact that it started with Deir Yassin. We'll talk about it a bit more in the testimonials, but there was an orphanage opened up in Jerusalem specifically because of this. Again,
there's
there's
no number to determine. It's impossible to determine the exact number of Palestinian children orphaned during the Nakba, because if you materially, if you're looking at it as a whole, the Nakba has been and will continue to be an ongoing trauma for anyone who survived it. Because it's had a devastating impact on, one, the Palestinian identity, Palestinian nationalism, Palestinian families, Palestinian men, women, children, old people, like the land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it undoubtedly led to a significant number of children losing one or both of their parents. If you consider from a population of 1.9 million, and from that, 750,000 Palestinians were made refugees out of it. Go ahead.
And there was eyewitness accounts with the Deir Yassin massacre where children were just wandering, and people who were walking away, you know, being exiled, would say, hey, come with me, we'll take care of you, we'll find your parents, and they were never found. Again, no official registry, so we don't have a comprehensive account or counts of how many Palestinians did become orphans. But UNRWA did estimate at least, they said over 10,000 of unaccompanied children were living in tents or makeshift shelters by 1950. So that's the number we have currently.
Before we jump into like the archival records and talking about history, I just want to say when we're talking about orphans, we're not talking about how like they just lost their parents. It's like, obviously, I think that's the first, like one of the first things we should say plainly, Palestinian children aren't being orphaned by misfortune or by accident. They're orphaned by design, right? Like by design, right? Systematically, relentlessly, and in full view of a world that pretends that it doesn't understand what's happening, right? You see this now in Gaza. Entire families have been erased in a single strike. Not displaced, erased, right, Petra? Children emerge from rubble with no one left, no parents, no aunts, no siblings, no one to tell them who they are or where they're from. In some cases, they don't even know their own last names. In others, their names are the only thing left. And usually it's written on marker in their thighs so that their corpses could be identified later. And this is not incidental. It's the updated blueprint of this Nakba. We have like numbers to go from 10,000, like Petra said, to over 30,000 in 1948, above of Palestinian children who were orphaned when Zionist militias depopulated over 500 villages. Mm-hmm. Children either fled alone into refugee camps, others were left behind. They were found weeks later by Red Cross nurses or UN observers. And they were shell-shocked is what they called it back then. They were silent. And Petra, you talked about we talked a little bit about like the trauma studies and how they just didn't speak ever again. And some children were not found at all, right? And the Nakba didn't just exile people from their homes. It separated generations because Nihna, Al Arab, or maybe at least the Palestinian and Lebanese, we live with our parents or we live with our grandparents. Like I can tell you, like in Lebanon, عنا شقة, right? عنا شقة بتكون بيت جدة أول شقة, then بيت خالة, right?
Yeah.
Or بيت عمي وبيت عمي فوقه وبيت عمي فوقه وبيت عمي فوقه.
Same.
And then literally that's how that's how we live. We live, and if we're not all there, we're all living in one shqa if you can't afford it, right? And you see this pattern being replicated faster, sharper, and algorithmically better, right, with AIs. And how Gaza's Ministry of Social Development has reported thousands of unaccompanied children. Most are not registered as orphans because their parents haven't been found or can't be identified. Others are technically still alive, but they're unreachable, and they're trapped in cities that no longer exist in Gaza. And we're left with children in limbo, right? So we're like left, Petra, think about it. We're left with babies in incubators and that no one comes for. Or toddlers wandering through shelters alone, kids in trauma wards screaming for moms who were buried a week ago. And this isn't isolated. This isn't like a one or two or three. This is thousands.
Mm-hmm.
This is about a generation being unparented in real time. And what do you call a people whose past is severed? Mid-sentence. You guys call them orphan, but in Palestine, orphanhood is never just personal. It's political, and it's the structural outcome of settler violence. So, like, do you remember that story of the baby?
I was. I was going to mention it. Did you know they had video evidence of it, like of the IDF soldier grabbing the little girl?
Video, or did they only have the recording?
Oh no, they found a video. I think it was released recently, and they're holy like, shit, I think it was like on Twitter. Yeah,
you know
it was,
how like, I got, you know,
mm-hmm.
Holy shit, you know how like deep I got into that, right, Petra?
I remember.
You remember how I got really into it? I went into like
there was it was like hashtag where's the Gazan girl after the video was released. It's insane, and to think. Paralleling it to what is happening now versus what happened back then, you know
how many kids were taken that they don't know that they're a fucking Palestinian.
Exactly, and just the trauma of it all, and it being, you know, not they can't speak about it because I remember my grandparents. Whenever I would ask them, they're dead now, but when I would ask them, my grandpa would be like, "Oh, I was a post." Office worker, I would give people their mail, da 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 da. And my grandma was like, I don't like talking about it. Like, we can't even talk to them about it because of the trauma that they dealt with. So imagine if they were orphans. They don't have a last name. They don't know who their dad or mom is. They don't know what village they're from. They just know that you're a refugee, you're thrown into a camp, and, you know, there you go. That's it. It's just insane. So to see the parallels of what's currently happening in Gaza and reading everything about Nakba, it's exactly what's happening. What happened in the Nakba is what's happening in Gaza.
That's why the Nakba is continuous, right? Mm. So like that's why it's important when we look at like, I don't know, just the status of like orphanhood, right? Like to be orphaned in the context of Gaza or Palestine, it's not simply to like lose your parents. It's to undergo severance, right? Like.
Yeah,
I don't know. It strips children of not only a familial guardianship, but the structures in which like you're told of your story, you're told of who you are, all of these things, and this is you're stripped of that, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's
your identity is gone. Like specifically as a Palestinian orphan, your identity is gone.
Right.
Like, you don't know.
I'm gonna like what remains of a child whose family line ends with them. Like, think about that. What, you know, like, what?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's very hard to comprehend.
Yeah, it's hard. And it's emotional, right? Because we're seeing that, like, oh, like, people are orphaned every day. And it's, yeah. And of course, it's sad. And it's always that, right? But when you look at, like, when a child loses a parent or parents in a genocide, or when, it's personal, sure. But when a child is orphaned by a state that was built to erase their people, it seems like that trauma is structural.
100%.
Does that make sense?
It's engineered. It's engineered that way because, and Hiba, you know how much I love this quote, but resistance is existence. So what is a Palestinian child without their existence? They don't know. All they know is you're Palestinian and you were kicked out, or you're 100%. A Palestinian living in Gaza and everyone was genocided. They don't know anything other than that. They would have to be taught, or they would have to go looking for it. You know?
You're not, it's so fucked because these children aren't inheriting land or language or lineage, but they're inheriting grief with an origin story that they don't know, and a name that no one remembers, or a face that, like, maybe someone will recognize because they look like somebody they knew, but, like, that's it. It's not just orphanhood. It's, like, the weaponization of absence. And, yeah, so, I don't know. We can move on to, like, I want to talk a little bit about, like, more a little bit about like UNRWA's emergency report.
Yeah, so UNRWA was officially created and established in 1949. It took over the refugee relief from the Red Cross. The Red Cross basically could not handle everything going on in multiple separate countries. So UNRWA, the UN created UNRWA, which is specifically for Palestinian refugees. They quickly tried to build child-specific services like children villages and orphan homes, which is so sad to even think about. They created school feeding programs for malnourished and neglected children. Some refugee camps also dedicated orphan quarters or foster systems for these Palestinian orphans. So again, we don't have an exact count of how many of our people were orphaned, but due to UNRWA creating all of these systems, we do know it had to be a lot. I also wanted to talk about UNRWA, how most people think it's only for, like, Gaza and Gazan aid. But UNRWA runs in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, all of these other countries, providing for refugees.
Also here
in America, yeah, because we are a refugee problem. We do have a refugee problem. Palestinians in diaspora, they do not get citizenship. Like, I know in Lebanon, unless your father is a Lebanese, you don't get that citizenship. Same thing in Jordan. If your father does not have a Jordanian citizenship, you will not get citizenship, making it harder for you to go to schools. So there are UNRWA-run schools in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, every other country as well. They give you this card. It's called the UNRWA card. It's green. I know it's green in Jordan. I don't know how it is in different countries, but it's green in Jordan. You put your family names on it. So, like, the mom, the dad, the kids. And this is how you go to get free education, free healthcare. Not really free. It's in Jordan specifically, it's free, but it's a very, very shitty situation. The schools are run down, horrible. Like, they're kind of disgusting. Same with the health facilities. It's free, but you have to wait ages to get a doctor. And again, it's not the best, like, it's not the cleanest, safest places. These are run down. They were tents. Like, everyone has to remember, all of these areas and places were tents. And the people, the Palestinians themselves, built them up with cement and stuff. So they are very, very run down, whether it's a school, whether it's a medical facility. So it's not the best. Like, when we say it's free, yeah, sure, they get, you know, they go and get a shot for free, but in a very not a place that you would take your child to. So there's that. We do know that in Lebanon, we have Shatila, right? Sabra Shatila. These are Lebanese refugee camps for Palestinians. They have very, very minimal resources. And then we have in Jordan, we have al-Baqa or al-Ba'a, Jarash, and we have al-Wahdat refugee camps. Mm-hmm. I was actually born in al-Wahdat refugee camp. W Wahdat refugees. But these camps didn't just take, you know, orphans and refugees from 1948. They also took them afterwards in 1967. And they tried to do a family unit for to unite people. So, you know, hey, what's your name? We'll try to find your parent. If they couldn't, they would either give these people to widowed caretakers or they would try to find extended families. Unfortunately, right, most of these children, these orphans, they didn't end up in institutional orphanage. They were usually given to extended families or other refugees that weren't family members at all. And this was because that the facilities were crowded. The tents were very, very crowded, very poor supervision. And there was a lot of neglect and abuse during this time, mostly for boys. Mostly boys were used for child labor. And to be honest,
our own people too, like, because there's even like, even within like Fatah, for example, in like the 70s and 80s would like, or 60s too, would recruit
the militias.
Recruit orphan kids with a dream of them being, or having like revenge for the people that made them orphans. And you see that. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're fine. But yeah, so that's like a bit of background on the refugee camps. The refugee camps, right? Specifically in Jordan, the biggest refugee camp is Al-Wahdat. It was established by UNRWA in 1955. Currently, it holds over 61,000 Palestinian refugees. Now, these refugee camps are actually disgusting. You can go search them up. There's sewage water everywhere. It's poverty stricken. Unemployment is very, very rampant. It's very hard to afford basic necessities. And you have multiple families living inside of these quote unquote houses. I wouldn't even call them houses. Mm-hmm. Most of them don't even have roofs. But yeah, in these refugee camps, they created, you know, schools, they created soccer camps, they created whatever they could. And then in Jordan, the second biggest refugee camp would be the Zara or Zarqa refugee camp. This one was established. It was one of the first ones in 1949. The population currently is roughly 20,000. Again, this is where my mom lived. Living conditions were horrible. They originally started with just tents, later replaced with concrete shelters. 19% of residents in these refugee camps live below Jordan's national poverty line. And that poverty line isn't very high, if you know about Jordan. They also suffer, 15% of them suffer from chronic health problems, and 68% of them are uninsured. So when we say, you know, they're getting free healthcare, not really. It's a very crappy healthcare.
Oh, extremely horrible, bro. I remember in Lebanon, I broke my... I know it's different because obviously I was an American also in Lebanon, but and a citizen. But I remember I wasn't allowed into the hospital unless I had to, when I broke my elbow, I wasn't allowed into the hospital unless my uncle could pay for it upfront. Yeah, and that was me. Imagine how people are dying. People die outside of hospitals.
Mm-hmm. It's insane. Yeah. Do you want to talk about the Lebanon refugee camps?
Yeah, I can. So the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon people call them like humanitarian failures. I don't know if you've seen that before, but they're not. It's political outcomes. So there's two, maybe I'll talk about Raifi Shatila refugee camp, which is kind of notorious. And then there's Burj al-Barajne, which is in Beirut. They were never meant to be like homes. They were meant to be... They were created to be holding zones for a population that no one really wanted to absorb, as we see with the surrounding Arab countries. And Lebanon, despite its own history of occupation, and civil war, you know, made a containment of its policy. So Shatila was established in 1949 in the wake of the Nakba, and it housed over 10,000 people today. And it's housed in conditions unfit for life. So it's overcrowded, it's under-resourced, and it's sinking into basically infrastructural decay. Shatila is more than a refugee camp. I would argue it's an archive of decades-long abandonment that we see the height of it during, you know, the massacre that happened in 1982. There's power outages, which, I mean, not unique to all of Lebanon, but you see sewage leaks, homes that are collapsing, and they're not exceptions, right? And you see children growing up here that they're not just poor, they're politically excluded. And school, like, they're not going to school. That if you go to school, you're, that's a luxury, right? And you, even employment is still a fantasy. Did you watch West Beirut?
I haven't, no.
Okay, so for those who have watched West Beirut, if you guys remember Omar from West Beirut, he's actually a Palestinian kid. Omar was like the guy's, his best friend, the main character's best friend. And he actually grew up in Shatila. And, you know, even like, it's really effed up because even after the movie was released or whatever, because he was a Palestinian, they didn't invite him to like the, what is it called? The premiere or whatever. It's so sad. Like, he was like walking by and he saw it, and he just happened to see it happen. And they're like, oh, come, faddal, come, whatever, whatever. And that's how he showed up. It's so mean, bro. It's so mean. It makes me want to cry, but whatever.
That's actually crazy.
His name is Muhammad, but he's safe. He was displaced in Lebanon after the war, but whatever. Anyways, that's Shatila. Then we have Burj al-Barajne, which holds an estimated 58,000 people, including, because this one also includes Palestinians as well as Syrians. So it has about 20,000 Palestinian refugees and about 40,000 Syrians. And the walls are rotting. Electric wires are hanging from like the fucking, from the ceilings. Families are like in, families pack into rooms meant for one person. And the Lebanese state maintains its longstanding, and I would argue legal apartheid, that Palestinians cannot own property. And since they're barred from most skilled professions, they face endless bureaucratic obstacles. And it's amazing. I love my people. I'm Southern Lebanese, mostly. You know this. And W Lebanonians, lesbians. while so many of us show solidarity with Palestine, especially Southern Lebanese, especially Junub Shiite Lebanon, of course, always 100%. But Lebanon as a whole has always seen Palestinian presence as kind of a threat. Right? We have the trauma of the civil war, and then you have the PLO's entanglement in Lebanese politics, and obviously deep sectarian anxieties. They've all contributed to the normalization of Palestinian exclusion in our government. So yeah, successive Lebanese governments, left, right, and even even within like the Mukawama, اللي بتشوفه بلبنان, they have all upheld that the Palestinian people deserve a right to return, which is 100% valid, right? However, this becomes an issue, right? When you see, I don't know, when you see that basically that you, they're still being held as a, they're still being viewed as non-citizens with this quote unquote safeguard as no, the Palestinians rajion, right? Like they have the right to return. This is a kind of my critique of it. Some people may not, but this is my critique of it, saying that Palestinians have a right to return, and that's the reason why they don't have citizenship in Lebanon or granted equal rights, or even not even equal rights, bro, but like give them the same rights that da'atu like اللي بيشتغلوا عندكم بالبيت. I don't know if that makes sense, right?
Yeah, like, no. It's the same. Well, I mean, it's better in Jordan. But yeah, like me and my dad always have this like debate, and he says the worst thing that ever happened for Palestinians was they were given citizenship. And I always argue like, no, because then they would just be living in refugee camps, not being able to work or travel or do anything. So even though I get that, like, you know, you have to stay as refugees so you can go back and return. But what are they doing currently? Like, what can they do currently? So I do understand. And it's even worse for people from Gaza, because people of Gaza are stateless, right? In Jordan specifically, my dad has a friend who came from Gaza. He actually like ran away. He went through Egypt and then went to Jordan. He's not able to get a passport and an ID. He can't buy a house. He can't rent a house. He is nobody. Like, you, if you're from Gaza, you have nothing, nothing at all when you escape, when you get out of there. Nothing. You are not, like, not even a second class citizen. You're like a 45th class citizen.
Literally.
And it's so bad. Yeah. And just to continue seeing it, like, I understand Palestinians have a right to return.
It's literally the fear of tawtin, right? You know what tawtin is?
Yes.
It's permanent resettlement. It's used as a justification to maintain Palestinians in this like legal limbo where they're not, you know what I mean? I don't know. It's like I feel like, I don't know. Personally, for me, I feel like one can uphold the right of return without denying a child the right to clean water, education, or medical care. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe that's just me, though.
Yeah. No, 100%. I will speak about like Jordan because that's what I know. On the IDs, on your whatever, if you're Palestinian, you're labeled as Palestinian. You're not labeled as Jordanian unless like you came from the West Bank in 1967 and like the annexation, all of that happened. Unless you came from there, if you're from the Nakba in 1948 and you were exiled, you're Palestinian. You don't get Jordanian citizenship. Even your passport, like it'll say you're a non-citizen Palestinian.
Right. And I don't know.
And it makes it hard. It makes it hard to travel. It makes it hard to do anything because you are stateless. You are a stateless person. You have no state.
Orphanage, it's like, it's here, you're not really like orphanhood here. When we talk about it, it's not always maybe like the loss of your biological parents, but it's about the absence of political guardianship.
Exactly. Yeah, we are orphaned. Like, even if you have both of your parents, mom, alhamdulillah,
we call Palestine our mom.
Yeah, Palestine is our mother. You like, that's a running thing with Palestinians. We don't have that. We're stateless. Same in Kuwait. Like in Kuwait, they are stateless. Like if you're a Palestinian in Kuwait, you don't have citizenship. I believe you can work and like do stuff like that, but you can't travel. And again, I get it. It's the right to resettlement and everything else. But what about what they can do now? And I feel like this is what led to a lot of like Black September in Jordan.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. They're like, hey, you need to either help us return or you need to give us the right. But yeah. So yeah, that's sorry about the little yap, but that's what it
no,
is.
No, please don't ever apologize.
But yeah. And then like, of course, the Syria refugee camps are just horrific, just knowing like the war that happened. They weren't just displaced one or two times. They were also, you know, I don't want to talk about Syria too much because we know what happens, but there was a refugee camp in Syria. It was established in 1948. Currently, it holds over 23,000 Palestinians. This is considered, or I'm sorry, it's called the Nidab refugee camp. It's considered one of the poorest Palestinian refugee camps in Syria. They don't even have houses. So these houses aren't really houses. They're stuck and consisting of World War II era barracks. They expanded due to like the refugee influx. They also have very, very limited access to basic services, infrastructure, and because of the war, they were kicked out from there or you know, like imprisoned within the refugee camps. So just a horrible place, whether you were kicked out of Palestine or you stayed in Palestine, just horrible all around.
100%. Sorry, I know we're going to kind of backtrack a little bit. We're going to backtrack a little bit because I know Petra talked about like Deir Yassin.
But I think that it's important to recognize how thousands of Palestinian children became orphans throughout and like during the Nakba, right? So you see, for example, the village where I'm from, or my Jeddah was from Ramle, right? So in Lid and Ramle, over 50,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled by Israeli forces, and it's called Operation Danny. Side note, do you know who like orchestrated Operation Danny?
Who?
You know the most peaceful prime minister of Israel?
Which one? They're all the so one, cute.
Rabin.
He wanted peace, Heba.
He's the one who orchestrated this. Isn't that crazy? The one who won, didn't he win a fucking Nobel Peace Prize?
He also was the one who orchestrated Deir Yassin.
Yelandino. Anyways, so families here were forced to walk miles, like miles on foot in like the summer heat without food or water. Hundreds died en route, some from dehydrations, and other were stopped for, were shot for stopping, right? And a lot of children watched their parents die from that. In many cases, only children reached the next village or camp. Right? And survivors even have witnessed seeing small bodies wrapped in cloth left by the roadside. Right? And Patura talked about like Deir Yassin, but we have like Tantura, Safsaf, Elaibun, Saliha, who all witnessed similar patterns, right? Civilians were rounded up, men were separated, executed, and Safsaf. Multiple women were reportedly raped before being killed, and children were often the only survivors because they were either too small to be noticed or were hidden by neighbors. Entire extended families were wiped out in single nights, and the result wasn't just orphanhood. It was an annihilation of lineages, and the children didn't end up in neatly like kept orphanages, right? Like, most were unaccounted for. Some were carried by strangers into refugee camps. Others survived alone by themselves. By 1949, UN observers began reporting the presence of quote-unquote unaccompanied minors, right? In camps like Khan Yunis, Nahr al-Bared, or Ain al-Hilwe, many of whom who had no identification, no surviving kin, and could not speak about what had been done to them or to their families. And the camps were not equipped to care for them, unfortunately. You see that the UNRWA's first annual reports describe children suffering from shock, malnutrition, and prolonged mutism. And it's mutism is basically them being silent. Them not talking. They can't talk.
The trauma of it all.
As we talked about it just right now about the conditions of the camps, but they lived in overcrowded tents. They ate rationed bread. And received little, I mean, how do you expect in 1949, do you think they'd be getting psychological help? Of course not.
No.
And the aid workers struggle to determine who the children belong to. And in most, if not all the cases, they didn't belong to anyone anymore.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and institutions, they registered them, but they registered them without any legal frameworks or reunification for long-term guardianship, right? So like, so many Petra slipped through the cracks, right? So like, for example, names being misspelled. Ask right now, go ask one of your kids how to spell her last name. Would she? No. How do they know how to spell it? Especially in Arabic, right? Files were lost, misspelled. Some children were renamed entirely by staff, and the orphans became a category. And the category was, quote-unquote, wards of the community, or, quote-unquote, others, right? And I don't know. I think that it's really, I really wanted to just kind of come back to this because it's important to talk about
it's very important.
There's no complete database of how many children were orphaned by the Nakba, and there is no like record of the names. And there hasn't been like really, there's been no meaningful effort by any international body to reconstruct missing lineages. What exists now are like fragments, right? So scattered documents, maybe some testimonies. And these kids didn't die. They weren't adopted. They were absorbed into systems. that classified them as others. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's this institute called the Nakba Archives. So Nakba-archives.org. It's Lebanon-based. They do have archives of, they're old now, but video of these people who were orphaned. And if you look at the names, you know, they don't have a last name. Salah al-Nasr, Ra'fat al-Nimr. They don't have like actual last names because, and like my husband's family, right? They don't know their last names. It's a random like Middle Eastern Arab first name. You know, that, and that's very, that's something that happens with a lot of Palestinians, and it happened with them. I agree with you. There was never any effort to go and see, hey, let's try to find your parents. Let's see what actually happened. Obviously, with the trauma happening to the children, and just there wasn't any resources. We were thrown from the Red Cross to the Arab Leagues to the UNRWA. And it was just
even okay, boarding schools.
Yeah, boarding schools. Make sure they're alive. That's fine. Whatever. Cool. Move on. And we have to like remember, come on, the refugee camps within Palestine. When we were researching, there was a woman.
By the way, what you were saying, sorry, real quick. In 1952, a field memo from a UNRWA camp in Gaza noted that, quote unquote, children whose guardianship could not be confirmed were entered into records under generic first names or with fabricated surnames.
Yeah, yeah.
So this proves it wasn't just a clerical issue. It was done. It was institutional.
Yeah, it was like, okay, Hiba, we don't know your last name. Okay, Hiba Muhammad, here you go. Like, that's how,
like,
it
literally
was.
Yeah. And like for example, you even know with me in my story, right? Like, for example, for my name is spelled wrong. Like, my legal name is spelled wrong than how it is spelled in Arabic. And I didn't know that for how old am
mine
I? I don't
too.
Know.
Mine too.
So when I would look up stuff about my family, I would never find it.
Yep.
Or I would find wrong things. And it's like this, like, even just, even the, like, the difference was an alif. Like, Patura, oh, the damn. Difference was an alif in my, like, last name. Like, here, I'm going to send it, like, I'm going to text you it so you know exactly what I'm talking about. So this is how I thought it was spelled, right?
Yeah.
Let me text it to you. sorry, I just want you to understand, right? But in actuality, it's spelled like this. Just the alif is what caused the difference. And I couldn't find anything on my family because of that.
Yeah.
So, like, imagine it.
Engineered, like what you said, it's systematically engineered to disconnect Palestinians from their heritage, from their family, from finding out what happened, from anything. And if you do have, like, grandparents or family, they don't even talk about it. So you have to go do it yourself. You know, and it's sad. You became an orphan because you lost your family, and then you were orphaned yet again. You lost your land.
100%.
It's insane. It's insane. But yeah, like, the refugee camps were also present inside of Palestine because they were kicked out of what we know as Palestine 48, or proper quote unquote Israel. They were kicked out from there. The people of Yaffa, Haifa, Lod, Deir Yassin were pushed out somewhere else, and there were refugee camps there. Gaza in particular, that's where a lot of, like, people from the West Bank got pushed into. That's why when we speak to people in Gaza, they're like, oh no, I'm not officially from here. I'm from Ashkelon or Ashkelon.
Yeah, so
I'm
many people. Here. There's so many people we've met that are like that.
Yeah, like Abu Siraj is from Yaffa, Khaled, where last week we were talking
last episode,
to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was from the outskirts of Gaza. So it's insane. There was a woman, her name is Im Hassan, they don't even have her full name, who was refugee during the Nakba in Gaza. She said she found two siblings all alone by themselves near Beit Hanun. And when she went and asked them, they said their parents were killed. You know? So just people running around, very chaotic, and just, I can't even begin to imagine how it was back then. I really and truly can't.
Me either. About?
Yeah.
The children who were orphaned in, from 1947 until 1949, right? They were rarely recorded beyond aid files and like whether or not they were going to receive food that day. Most of their names were lost, and their stories were never followed up. Today,
we see the same violence continue, right? But today we have witnesses. And however, though, there are also people who forced the nation or forced the system to listen to them, which is what you see with a lot of the like archival testimonies and oral histories of the the Nakba that you see in today's times.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to recount one specific story or testimony from the Nakba archives.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from Amina Hassan Bennett. She was born in 1931 in Sheikh Tanun, Palestine. And this is an interview with her. So the interviewer asks her, how big was your family? How many brothers and sisters were you? So she goes, three of them. One of them is blind. They got him in the eye when he was young and he lost his vision in both eyes. He's still with us. I have one brother who is still alive. My older brother died. I did not see him. My mother died. I did not see her. My father died. I did not see him. I have two sisters. They died. I did not see them. I'm here in Lebanon, all by myself. I do not have a brother, nor a mother, nor a father, nor anybody at all. I only have a son here in Lebanon and two daughters. Nobody else. My four sons went missing in 1982. My husband received a projectile on his head while he was at home. His brain spilled on the ground and we buried him. And there I was, looking for my missing children.
Oh my God. That's insane.
Yeah.
She lost her whole family, and then after she lost her husband.
Her husband and her kids. Oh. And she's now like, what? Like, this is how it's a system, how it's mm-hmm. done, right? Like how someone still suffers to this day. You know? Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah.
It's just so fucked.
It's insane. Yeah. It's very, like what Hiba said, it was very, very hard to try and find testimonials. Again, with everything we know, these children didn't want to talk, couldn't speak, trauma. So we rarely get full-on conversations with them. So just, you know, to get anything was incredible. What I found was this RochesterBeacon.com. This was from this year, actually. It was an interview with a girl named Fatima and her grandma. We never get the name of the grandma, but we get the story. And this goes back to Deri Yassin. Again, I know I keep saying it, but it was a very important massacre. So at first she talks about the Deri Yassin was a very prosperous community, a village once alive with laughter of children. They also continue to say it was very peaceful village. Despite the escalation and tension during the British mandate, the village had non-aggression agreements with neighboring settlements. She then continues to recount her family's memories in Deri Yassin. The Deri Yassin massacre was a tipping point in the violent exodus of Palestinians. On the morning of April 9, 1948, Fatma's grandfather woke the family in a hurry before dawn, alerted them that the village night watchman of an imminent attack from the Zionist militias. Her grandfather was only 30 years old. He went, he grabbed his old Ottoman rifle, told his 25-year-old wife to lock the door as he ran out with other men into the darkness. He never came back, Fatma's grandma says. Her grandma says she was huddled with her five children, ranging in age from 4 months to 10 years, in a corner of their house, and they tried to keep as quiet as they could while the militia raided the village. A grenade crashed through their window and exploded in an empty room. The blast caused one of the babies to cry and alerted the militia outside. They banged on the door and tried to force their way inside. Fatma's grandmother recalls the gunmen shouting, "Are there any men inside?" She replied, "No." Then they said, "Open the door, we will let you live." She pleaded with them. She said, "You have to swear by your 10 commandments that you will not kill me or my children." They swore. They swore, so she unlocked the door and the militiamen barged inside and forced the family out. Fatma's grandmother packed and handed out a bundle of belongings to Fatma's father. Her father remembered how a militia member stopped him, took the bundle, and said, "You'll have it when you come back." So they didn't even let them take anything. When her father stepped out... I mean,
there's stories. Like, there's stories about the people that there was still hot food on the table.
Yeah, yeah. When Fatma's father stepped outside, bullet casing covered the yard. Fatma remembers her father telling her how, as a five-year-old, he was very excited at first. Any little boy might have started jumping and shouting, "Look at all of these shells." Her grandmother, though, remembers it differently. She looked past the casing and saw the bodies of her family and neighbors murdered outside their homes. She recalled how a female member of the militia searched their clothing and pulled out gold jewelry, cash, and cash that has been tucked away in the baby's clothes. Everything of value was stolen. The militia then rounded up all the survivors, mostly women and children, along with seven elderly men, and quarreled them together. Fatma's grandmother was reunited with one of her sisters, who told her their mother had been killed. For 9 agonizing hours, they were forced to stand under the sun. A truck then arrived, and they took the survivors to a nearby settlement, Givat Shul, and paraded them through the streets. The grandma says, "The brutal treatment and dehumanization left a permanent scar in my memory." Unfortunately, though, Fatma's grandma was now widowed, robbed, and homeless, and she had 5 children to take care of. She found out that there was an orphanage created in Jerusalem due to the Deir Yassin massacre called Dar al-Atfal, and it was founded by Hind al-Husseini. Because the grandma was unable to keep any of the children, she gave them all up except the youngest because she was nursing. She grieved the loss of her living children, 2 daughters and 2 sons, including Fatma's father. After years in the orphanage, Fatma's father and his brother were able to reunite with their mother, but the 2 eldest daughters had to stay and they graduated from the orphanage school. They only saw their mothers for visits. The family then eventually relocated to another village and then moved into Jordan to build their houses. Yeah. So, I'm just trying to imagine. Like, imagine you as a 25-year-old, your husband goes out, you know, to fight. You're stuck with 5 children, a baby, 4 months to 10 years old. They stole from you. You have nothing. You're homeless. And the only way to make sure that your kids survive is putting them in an orphanage.
Like, that's so fucked.
It's so fucked. It's
but they so were, fucked. You know, you said that they were.
Yeah, a happy ending. Called? Yeah.
I mean, happy is as happy as it could get, right? Quote unquote, right?
Yeah, they were reunited. The Hind al-Husseini orphanage, this woman, right? She rescued over 55 survivors from the Deir Yassin. I read that story. Yeah, it's actually amazing what she did, and it became a sanctuary for orphans all throughout the Nakba and everything else. It still stands till this day.
Yeah. Before we conclude, let's kind of bring it to present day, right? So, in April 2024, a residential building in Rafah was hit by an Israeli airstrike. Among the dead was Sabreen Al-Sakani, a 30-year-old woman in her 3rd trimester of pregnancy. Her husband and daughter were also killed. When civil defense workers reached the site, they found her body under rubble, still pregnant. And this became, you know, the most widely circulated image of quote-unquote hope during the genocide in Gaza. And it wasn't a ceasefire, and it wasn't a diplomatic breakthrough. It was a baby whose name was Malak, delivered from the womb, or from the carcass, I guess, so fucked, of her dead mother underneath the rubble. She was still attached by the umbilical cord when rescue workers pulled her from the wreckage. And the blast had, like I said, killed her entire family. Cameras captured her tiny body ash covered and barely breathing, and the world called it a miracle. And this is, I think, what we mean when we say that Palestinian grief is misread or institutionalized. Mm. The moment wasn't fucking miraculous. It was genocide's most romanticized and misinterpreted tragedy. And it was turned into a viral parable of, like, resilience with a fist. And it was turned into something for global consumption, right? Like, her Malak's birth was treated like a symbol, but symbols don't bury their mothers the moment they are born. The truth is, she was fucking born an orphan, a child of the Nakba, not in 1948, but in 2024. Her story became the most weaponized hope, quote unquote, hope narrative of the genocide, precisely because it made the most, it made unbearable violence look almost beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like when you see like a little flower sticking up under the rubble, you know? It's bullshit. It's palatable and even like redemptive, right? People shared it, like, and they were like, oh, life always finds a way. But they fucking, like, what they failed to fucking forget or consider was the fact that why life had to claw its way out from under a fucking massacre that targeted a family.
Mm.
Right? 12 other kids died in that strike. 12. Right? So I just think that when we talk about, you know, Palestinian children being turned to symbols, this is exactly what we fucking mean, right? She was, when we talked earlier about babies in babies in incubators with no one to claim, we were talking about Malak, right?
Yeah.
She was 1.4 kilograms.
At all.
And her birth, like I said, wasn't a miracle. She was born an orphan. Her mom, her dad, her sister was already dead. She had no home. Under the rubble. No home to return to. No one to claim her. And her life started from the wreckage. And Malak became the most visible orphan of at least in the time frame in 2024 of the genocide. But her case isn't exceptional. It's one of the few that was caught on camera, right, Petra? And
yeah.
Most children orphaned in Israeli airstrikes are never identified publicly. Many die before they're even named. So you have an orphan named one day and then the next, because he's in a fucking camp and they target camps, he's dead. And, like, do you remember that video of the Palestinian kid? It fucked with me. It was one of those videos for me. But it was a Palestinian kid and he had, like, 12 members of his family laying out in front of him in the white. And he was like walking back and forth trying to determine or trying to see who he should kiss first, who he should say goodbye to first. That kid is an orphan.
Mm.
Right?
The video of the kid, Salah, everyone knows Salah, right? He posted it. He was walking and he saw a kid lying on the floor. He's like, "Hey, wake up. Why are you here?" He was like, "Oh, this is my mom. I'm laying with her. His mom is under the ground." And he was like, "I just miss her, so I have to sleep here every night for like with her." Like, the baby girl who was carrying her sister on her shoulders, and she's like, "I'm tired, but I have no one. I have to take her to the hospital." Like
Malak and these kids' survival, it doesn't negate the violence that produced it or produce them, right? It basically showcases it, illustrates it. They're not symbols of resilience. Basically, what she is she's a symbol of she's a living example of a system that annihilates families and produces children who not only like are grieving, but they inherit grief before they can even form a breath. Yeah. Think about it, Petra. Before she can even form a breath, her first breath, she was inherited grief.
Yep.
And
she's not, I don't know, like, it's sad because she's not the only one. Remember Ayman Hiba, the journalist? Ayman. Yeah. So when on Christmas Day,
yep.
So we knew.
Alayhi we talked Hama. About the story a couple days ago.
Yeah, we knew Ayman. Yeah, his name is Ayman Al-Jadi. He was a journalist. He was an amazing person. always had a smile on his face. The last time we talked to him, I asked him what his favorite food was, and he said msakhan.
And I was like, he's gonna invite us over.
Yeah, he was like, I'm gonna invite you guys over after this and we'll eat it. I was like, inshallah. And we were like, we'll cook for you.
And then we started talking shit about Ghazan food or Ghazawi food. I remember.
It's like, it's too spicy, but even for me, Allah yirhamo. But on Christmas Day in 2024, his wife was going to Al Auda Hospital to give birth to his very first child. And he was so happy, so ecstatic. So he invited a few of his journalist friends. They were in the journalist car celebrating, right? Waiting for the birth. And he was killed. So Ayman's son.
There was a direct airstrike on his vehicle, on a journalist marked vehicle.
Burnt alive while celebrating and waiting for his wife to give birth. So Ayman's son, they named him Ayman, by the way, was born without a dad. Without a dad. And so, I don't know. Like, it's such a hard thing
to discuss. It's not that. It's okay, so for every orphan whose rescue is captured and shared, there are thousands, you know, who are under rubble or shelter or in shelters or inside overcrowded hospital wards. Their names don't trend and their grief doesn't circulate, but people still see it and they speak. And in every hospital and displacement site in Gaza, there are children who lost their entire families. They're not anonymous cases. They are witnessed by doctors, aid workers, and when possible, surviving relatives. So I'm going to go through a few of them. A trauma surgeon at Al-Shifa Hospital told The Guardian, "We admitted a child with burns over half her body. Her father carried her in and then collapsed. He had been holding himself together just long enough to reach us. He died in the hallway. She kept asking when he would come back." A nurse at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital told Euromed Monitor, "We received 5 children from the same family. One of them kept asking why her parents were sleeping. She didn't understand. She refused to eat until someone brought them to her." In the Nusayrat camp, an aid worker from the Palestinian Red Crescent described a 5-year-old boy who arrived alone after surviving a drone strike. "He had no shoes, no name. He wouldn't speak for days. We gave him a name just to register him, but he still won't answer to it. He just sits and waits." These aren't exceptional stories. According to Gaza's Ministry of Social Development, like I stated earlier, over 17,000 children were classified as unaccompanied or orphaned. The actual number...
Yeah, it was updated. Sorry, Hiba. It was updated April of 2025. It's up to 39,000 now.
Yeah, so that's the actual number is far higher given ongoing communication failures. But older children too are navigating this alone. So a teenage girl interviewed by Al Jazeera said, "In Rafah, she said, when the strike happened, I was upstairs. My mother, father, and brother were all downstairs. I saw what was left. I haven't slept once. They ask if I have any relatives. I say no. I say don't ask again." And mental health professionals, they report widespread signs of acute trauma, mutism, right? Disassociation, hypervigilance, but there are almost no functioning services to treat it. Children are stabilized and they are sent off like with nowhere to go, right? Mm-hmm. And one field nurse summarized the situation clearly. She said, "Some of these kids aren't just mourning. They're alone in the world. No documents, no next of kin, no one left. And they're not isolated cases. They're part of a system that produces orphanhood through military strategy. And like the children of 1948, most of them will never be traced again." I don't know, I just...
Yeah, like current day genocide, we have obviously more testimonies, more evidence of this. There was a little kid, he's 10, his name is Osama. He said they were, you know, interviewing kids in a camp, like a tent, just a bunch of kids, and they asked him, "Hey, what are you doing here?" He's like, "I'm here, I'm hanging out with my friends because I just want to forget. I just want to forget the war. I look at my destroyed home here and think about the memories I had with my mom and my dad in their room. Now it's all gone. We used to have fun every day, sit in the kitchen, play together at home. Now it's all gone. I just want to forget everything. I want to have fun."
their children. And I think before we end, I just, when it, for Palestinians, right, exile is not a singular event, right? It's a condition that begins with the loss of a family or the loss of your land, and it extends to every system that you're absorbed into, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it be UNRWA, whether it be in diaspora, whether it be whatever the case is, right? And it's spatial, it's psychological, it's political, and it doesn't end with your survival. Specifically, children orphaned in war or genocide are not only displaced from people, they're displaced from, like, continuity, from an identity, from recognition. And because the systems that process them, they don't track lineage or land claims or belonging. These children grow up with no legal foundation. And refugee camps, orphan children have historically been treated as social dependents, not political subjects. They're stateless, right? And it's treated bureaucratically. By the time they reach adulthood, many of have no way to prove who their parents were or where they came from. If they had inheritance, they can't claim it. They can't legally return to homes they never really knew, right? And it's not only political or legal, it's psychological. Multiple studies on just specifically, we're not even going to talk about trauma studies, right? We'll talk about just specifically like Palestinian refugee children across generations. It shows that compounding effects of unresolved trauma, loss of trust, identity confusion, persistent grief, and intergenerational anxiety, these outcomes are more severe in children who experience the loss of one or both parents due to military action, right? And these studies are tested independently in all of the camps that Petra and I listed. So they're all existing independently of each other. It's not like, oh, it just happened to be in Lebanon that these children... No, no, no. It's in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, and in Palestine. These children were all basically saying that this is the effects of trauma. These are the effects of the trauma on them. It was like universal. And I don't know. I think that when you look at like, I don't know, like when you see that the trauma isn't narratable, right? We see so many situations of silence. My family, like my Jido didn't talk about it. He was an orphan of the Nakba. Me and you, when we were researching, we couldn't find many stories of firsthand accounts of Nakba orphans.
Yeah,
because usually there's no extended family to reconstruct the story. There's no community that survived enough to explain what happened. And children are left with like only a little bit of knowledge that their parents died, that they're Palestinian, and that there is nowhere left to go back to. In Gaza today, the situation is worse. Children are not just experiencing trauma. They're inheriting unresolved wars or genocide, right? They're aging inside an environment that offers no healing, no restitution, or long-term protection. And I think that's what makes orphanhood in Palestine so unique. It's not only about loss, it's about the permanent disruption of political independence. And it's an exile without an end. I don't know.
No, 100%. I agree. And there's no end in sight. Like, there isn't.
No,
like, even in Gaza specific, like, just Gaza now, we don't know. We don't know if this genocide is going to end. And when it does, is it going to, like, it needs years to rebuild, years
decades.
To count our debt. Yeah.
Well, decades. Even like in 2023, they were still rebuilding from 2021.
Yeah. 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 2008, 2014, 2021, 2023.
Mm-hmm.
Every few years, something happens. More orphans are there, more unresolved issues, more buildings just crashing, and it's never ending. And how do you as a child, like, you, they're not even post-traumatic, like there's no post-traumatic disorder for them because they're currently living it. They're like their nervous system is always living through this no matter what.
Before we end, I think we started doing this a couple episodes ago, which I love. Because like action items for people to do.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, throughout this episode, we've traced maybe, you know, there was obviously children who were orphaned before 1948. Petra, like you were telling me about the children orphaned from the
The revolts.
The Arab revolts, yeah.
Yep.
The Arab revolts, and they were erased from history to the children orphaned today in front of cameras. You know, the way that the occupation does it has changed, but, you know, the systems have adapted to it, and the outcome remains since Palestinian children are being unparented by force, and then they're reclassified in institutions that don't know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so we're tune in next week, you guys, for part two, because we're going to go deeper into what happens after you're an orphan or after you're exile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, so, but specifically, here's what you can do. Okay. Stop sharing without consent or without context.
Mm.
If you repost images of Palestinian children, especially orphans, make sure you're not framing them as symbols of resilience. Say their names, say what killed their families, right? Learn their history. Yeah. Go beyond the headlines, study the structure, the Nakba, how it's ongoing, the UNRWA camp system, the history of institutional erasure. Read about the refugee children of 1948, not just the ones trending in 2024 because they were born underneath the rubble, right? When you hear someone describe this as a conflict, ask them how many orphaned children Israeli children there are.
Mm.
Ask why Palestinian children are always expected to survive beautifully, silently, and without parents. Stop romanticizing survival. The child that you called a miracle is an orphan. The family you gave that gave you hope and made you find your religion in 2024, you know, I'm glad to the allies. I'm glad that, you know, you're finding religion through our blood and dead children. But, you know, they were killed. You know, so many people I know with Khaled, Allah yirhamo, he gave him hope. He was kissing her eyes. He was killed. When you aestheticize Palestinian survival, you're helping people forget what created it.
Mm.
Don't reframe genocide as resilience. Like, I don't know. Learn what it is to be Palestinian or what Palestine is. Without Zionism.
Before you even try to speak for Palestinians as well, learn.
Listen.
We don't need you to learn the history. Like anyone can go pull it up and look at it. Learn Palestinians. What makes a Palestinian? Why is this plight so important? Why are we still fighting? And it's not just Zionism. I love what you said, Hiba. Outside of Israel, outside of Zionism, what is it to be a Palestinian?
There are so many people who, like Petra, you know, this point bothers me so much, which is why I created the community that I did. It's because people only view Palestine through the lens of Zionism.
Yep.
Right? Only through the lens of either a debate or through, you know, calling out Israel. But when we remove, like, you know, if the end game is liberation, if the end goal is to get rid of Zionism, then what are we? Do we exist after? If we're only viewed through the lens of Zionism or the effects of Zionism has had on our people. And then, like, with even when they view us through the effects that Zionism has had on our people, they don't even talk about the individualized effects. They don't talk about the trauma. Mm-mm. They talk about us through numbers, through statistics, through like
historical events.
I don't know. It just really fucked up, right?
Yeah. And I feel like this is why it was very important to not do the cliche, this is what the Nakba did. Da, da, da. Like we want you guys to understand it's much more than Zionist came and, you know, exiled over 500 villages and exiled 750,000 people. What was the aftermath of that? What happened to those people after? There were orphans, like the trauma, all of this. Do you guys look into that, or are you just here to like see what happened and that's it? That's where you stop.
Are you going to your school, city, or government and like levels? Are you divesting? Mm-hmm. Are you seeing if your school, your city, your governmental structures are partnered with Israeli institutions? We see, like, for example, like Maya, God bless her right now, is what, day 9, I think, or day 7, 8 of her fucking hunger strike by herself. Where's everyone? Organize. Don't be abstract, bro. And then please, for the love of God, for the love of God, or Jesus, or Hashem, or the frog god, please stop, like, highlighting war criminals as proof of their crimes. Fuck breaking the silence. Fuck these people who are sitting on these platforms every single day, who are being praised by Palestinians or Palestinian allies, and they're being, oh, look at them, look at, they're talking about all the horrible shit that they did to a Palestinian family. Well, speak to a Palestinian, they'll tell you. These people are only speaking because they're not being prosecuted. They can't be held prosecuted for what they did. And look at how Israel is treating now, and that the world is, like, now, what's it called, blacklisting and arresting IDF soldiers. If you guys go look at their posts, they're blurring out pictures of their soldiers.
Yeah.
Because they don't want them to be arrested. So why are we promoting this? Why are we taking a war criminal's words? We've been telling you this for decades. Listen to us. That's it. I'm done. Go ahead, Petra. I'm done.
I couldn't have said it better myself. W Hiba for always, like, stating everything that's on my mind.
Yeah, I love you.
I love you 100%. Listen to a Palestinian. Better yet, listen to, like, the Gazans on the ground. I don't know if you guys are aware, we're recording today, May 15th, but it's getting really, really bad. Palestinians in Gaza are saying their goodbyes on social medias. They're saying
Bisan stopped posting.
Bisan has stopped posting. They're saying they're using, like, new weapons that they haven't seen before. This is the end. And so what are we doing for them? Are we just sitting and saying, I'm pro-Palestinian, woo, debate as I owe, or are we actively on an anonymous account,
not doing anything, afraid to lose your job, afraid to be doxxed?
But yeah, so this was a tougher episode, but it had to be said. And, you know, we've reached the end of the episode for Palestine Exists, which means we will be commemorating another martyr. Humanize Gaza is a project to make sure our people in Palestine, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, and our people in Lebanon and Yemen who have been martyred for the cause are never forgotten. You can always find more martyr stories if you go to humanizegaza.org. You can subscribe to the newsletter. We post there every day at least 2 to 5 martyr stories with their pictures. And yeah, so today's story is going to be Sanaa Ar-Rayes. She was a 25-year-old woman. Her martyr date was December 6th of 2023. Sanaa was a 25-year-old mother, wife, daughter, and sister. Everyone used to call her the soul of the family. Sanaa got married 2 years ago to the love of her life, Jihad Ishtawi. They had a beautiful baby boy named Ayman. They were making plans for their future. They were trying to build a successful life together and adding to their family and living life. Unfortunately, on December 6, 2023, Jihad and Sanaa went to find baby clothes for Ayman because the winter was coming and they wanted to find warmer clothes. They were hit with a missile from the Zionist entity. That missile made Ayman an orphan. A month after the strike, Jihad's body was found and they buried him. But Sanaa's body has never been found and her family is still searching to bury her and her dignity. Ayman is an orphan. These are the people that matter and these are the stories that often do not get heard because it's not a miracle, like Hiba said, or it's not newsworthy. Again, there are over 39,000 Palestinians in Gaza who are currently orphaned. And probably much, 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 much more. I hope everyone who listens to us will be there for the aftermath of everything. But yeah, Allah yirhamhum ya Rab. And may Allah protect Ayman.
Allah yirhamhum. Thank you, Petra, for sharing that.
Of course. Thank you, Hiba, as always. And yeah, like I'm shocked. This episode was hard.
Go drink water. Go take care of yourselves, everyone.
Thanks for listening. See y'all next
time. See you next week for part 2.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.